Wild oat is one of the most serious grassy weeds on the prairies. Losses from wild oat can be as high as $500 million annually. This is due to yield loss, dockage, cleaning costs, and lower grade and quality. Wild oats are also getting harder to manage as a result of herbicide resistance. Once wild oats develop resistance to groups 1 and 2, you are mostly limited to soil-applied pre-emergent herbicides. Resistance to those have already been found in all three prairie provinces. As a tool to help farmers manage this issue, the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee was formed. In partnership with the Canadian Weed Science Society, the goal is to educate and engage farmers to develop and adopt approaches to manage wild oats. Sask Wheat is a proud funding partner of this initiative. To chat more about wild oat and the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee, I have with me today Dr. Brianne Tideman. Brianne is a research scientist with Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada in Lacombe. Her research program focuses on management of herbicide-resistant weeds, integrated weed management, and novel weed management practices. Thanks for joining us today, Brianne.
Thanks for having me.
Let's jump right in. For anyone who has never heard of the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee, maybe can you tell us what it is?
Absolutely. So it is a cross-industry committee, and we are really working to provide resources, information, data, resources, anything we can kind of think of that farmers or the industry might need or use in order to help manage the wild oat resistance problem. So in particular, resistant wild oat, but really just wild oat as a pest as well. And believe it or not, we are not the first Wild Oat Action Committee to exist in Western Canada. We are sort of the reboot, if you will, of the original Wild Oat Action Committee, which was originated in, I believe it was the 1970s, when selective germinicide herbicides came out, the group ones and the group twos. It was sort of thought that the wild oat problem was solved. And as weeds tend to do, they proved us very wrong.
Where did the idea come from for the revamp of the committee?
So there was actually a letter that was sent to the Canadian Weed Science Society in 2017. And it was sent by Dr. Neil Harker and Ken Eshpeter, who is a farmer near Daysland, Alberta. So they had had some conversations. Ken was really concerned about dealing with resistant wild oat and felt like there should be sort of a concerted effort. But again, across industry. So it's not just researchers or agronomists. It's researchers, agronomists, chem company representatives, farmers, the commodity group representatives. It's sort of as many people as we can get that would have a vested interest in wild oat. We're trying to pull them into this committee. So a letter was sent to the Canadian Weed Science Society, where a resolution was passed at that meeting that they agreed there should be the formation of a subcommittee of the Canadian Weed Science Society called the Wild Oat Action Committee. And after that meeting, Eric Johnson agreed to sort of serve as the first chair of this reboot of the committee. We decided to sort of differentiate it a little bit. Instead of just being the Wild Oat Action Committee, we'd be the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee, just to sort of emphasize where we're at now. So the steering committee formed really in March of 2020. There's a bit of a gap there. It just took a little while to sort of get organized, figure out how and where and what our mission would be and how we'd get underway and get acting in the industry. And so we formed a steering committee in 2020, sort of developed our mission and have been trying to gain some momentum since then.
So with so many different people on the committee, what is your role and maybe who else is on it?
I am currently one of the co-chairs. I just came in as co-chair in January of 2023 when Eric Johnson retired. Sad face. So Eric Johnson was our original chair. And then when he retired in March, he sort of transitioned it over to myself and to Kelly Bowles, who's an agronomist. He's my other co-chair. And then we have Nathan Eshpeter, who is our project manager. We've got farmers. So Ken Eshpeter is on the committee. Of course, one of the original letter writers. He's on there as a farmer. Industry members from Corteva, MBASF, the weed specialist from Saskatchewan and Manitoba, so Clark Brenzel and Kim Livingston-Brown, myself as a research scientist, Charles Geddes, Sean Sharp, Rob Golden from University of Manitoba, representation from commodity groups. So we've got Jeremy, we've got yourself, we've got Mitchell Japp. I know I'm missing a bunch of people, but that's sort of off the top of my head who I can spell.
That was a pretty good list. So, and if we're forgetting anyone, they're probably listed somewhere. So
that is they are, yes. And I apologize to whoever I missed off the top of my head.
Perfect. Well, that is a lot of great resources coming together to be able to help farmers. So what would you say is kind of the main goal of the committee and how is this really going to benefit farmers?
I'll actually give you our mission statement here. So we are a cross-industry committee devoted to developing herbicide-resistant wild oat management solutions through producer engagement, knowledge transfer, and research. We are working in a lot of various areas. We're still in some ways sort of in that growth phase of figuring out how best to implement that mission and how best to not reinvent the wheel or not step on anyone's toes, sort of figuring out what our best place is in the industry. So there's sort of continual adaptation and continual growth happening there, but that's really our goal. Some of it is making sure producers know about research that's already been conducted and trying to get that information out to them, because we do get questions on, you know, you really need to do this type of research. And it's like, well, that research has been done. So trying to get some of that out to them, trying to understand what other questions producers have, what technologies they might be willing to try to manage wild oats, because that's always a fun, what should I do? And you offer an example and they go, well, I don't want to do that. What else you got? So what are you willing to try? What are you willing to try on your farm? And just down to really practical resources, like where do I get resistance testing done? And how do I sample wild oats for resistance testing? Things like that. So we're really in a whole bunch of different areas trying to serve the egg community in the area of wild adults.
So you've taken a lot of this information and you've turned it into resources such as videos and infographics. So can you just talk about some of those and where farmers can find them?
Absolutely. So if you go to weedscience.ca, under the resources, there is a Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee link, and all of our videos and infographics are posted there. We have long form videos, we have short form videos that can be used on social media and that type of thing. All the infographics are there, they're downloadable. We also do have a Twitter account, X account, I guess it's an X account now, at R Wild Oat, the letter R and then Wild Oat. We're not super active on Twitter and we're kind of monitoring the whole Twitter X situation to see what we're going to do there. We're also looking to get a few other social media accounts set up in the next little bit to make it a little easier to find us. That weedscience.ca under the resources, the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee is really where you can find all of those resources that we've prepared to date.
Awesome. And maybe one of my favorite resources and also one of our communications people favorite resource is the Elvis impersonator one. So I couldn't do this podcast without asking, what was the inspiration for that one?
So the Elvis. Elvis is wild oat. That is actually something that was taught to me when I was a graduate student. So when I started with Linda Hall's group at the University of Alberta, I knew how to ID wild oat, but we were in the field, we were working with some summer students, and Keith Topinka, who was a longtime technician for Linda, was asking some of our summer students if they knew how to identify wild oat. And there was a couple that didn't. They were new to us, summer students, new to the ag industry. And he said, I'll tell you, the easiest way to remember it is to think Elvis. And I happened to be with him and I went, what are you talking about, Keith? Like, I do not understand. And when he explained it to me, it stuck in my head because it's such a unique, quirky take on a weed ID. It's something that I've continued using. I use it for our students that all look at me like I'm insane. But I have students that I've talked to, you know, 4 or 5 years after they worked with me and they go, I still remember how to ID wild oats. So that one has gone, that's as close as we've come to going viral, is our Elvis wild oat ID. So if anyone hasn't seen it, basically the fact that wild oat doesn't have auricles or claspers around the stem, it's got a deep V like Elvis's deep V in his shirt. The ligule is tall and membranous and it's kind of swoopy like Elvis's hair. And then on the side of the leaf blades, there's little hairs that are like Elvis's tassels. And then a lot of you will have heard about the counterclockwise twist on the wild oats. That's the hip swivel.
Nice. I am never going to forget how to identify wild oat ever again.
It is quirky and it's weird, but it sticks in your head because of it. And it's awesome. I sometimes get credited with that, but that is all Keith Topinka. I don't know where he got it from or if he made it up, but I can't take the credit for it. It makes sense and it's so visual. But yeah, I wish I could take the credit for it, but I just take credit for bringing it to the world.
So now that we've talked about how to identify wild oat, maybe we can just kind of jump right into some more information on it. So maybe can we just start about what is the current issue of wild oats? Like, what are farmers dealing with in their field? What is the herbicide resistance issue right now? And maybe just expand on that a bit.
Yeah. So wild oat has always been one of the more common weeds, I would say, across the prairies. If you go back in the prairie weed abundance surveys that are currently led by Julia Leeson from Ag Canada Saskatoon, you'll see they're often in the top three. They've been bumped a little bit the last couple of years with some weird, I would say there's been a little bit of weird weather maybe influencing some of that, or some other weeds, kochia becoming a bigger problem in some areas, bumping it up the list. But wild oat has always been typically top three or at minimum top five. So it's always been a common problem on the prairies. As I said with the previous Wild Oat Action Committee, when we got our selective graminicides, our group ones and the group twos, we sort of thought we solved the wild oat problem. The response of wild oats to the selection pressure put on by the group ones and twos has been the evolution of resistance to those products. And so what we're seeing now is across the prairies, substantial resistance to the group one herbicides, not as much, but increasing resistance to the group two herbicides, and in a lot of cases, multiple resistance to both the group ones and the group twos. And so a lot of farmers, if you lose all of the subgroups of the group one and group two herbicides, you're really left with very few selective in-crop herbicide options in a bunch of crops. Your pulses, your cereals, even your canola is sort of your saver with Liberty and glyphosate, but the pulses and the cereals in particular, there's really no other selective in-crop herbicide groups that will affect wild oat. There are pre-herbicides that can be used, so pre-emergence or preceding herbicides, soil-applied herbicides, residuals that can be used for management of wild oat. Triolator Avidex is one that's commonly talked about. One of the concerns that we've had with that we've tried to highlight to folks is that in the 90s, there was quite a bit of Avidex resistance found in the prairies. And we are seeing a bit of I would say already a little bit of a turnaround where we're starting to hear a little more about Avidex resistance again, with increased use trying to manage the group one and two resistance. The other thing that's happened recently, some of the other products that we have would be group 15s like pyroxasulfone. In the last year to year and a half, the Herbicide Resistance Action Committee, the global group that sort of decides herbicide modes of action and all those types of things, reclassified Triolate, which was a group 8, into a group 15. So it used to be we had group 8 products and we had group 15 products and we knew we had some group 8 resistance. And now they're both group 15 products. And we don't know if there is automatically cross resistance between those products or if it's like the group 1s where your FOPs and your DIMs are both group ones, but slightly different. So there's some questions there in terms of what that means for resistance management with wild oat. Can be challenges with using residual herbicides for weed management because you do rely on needing some moisture, which has been hard to come by in some places the last few years. And if you don't have moisture, then the product's not active. They're typically less effective than some of those selective graminicides, the in-crop group ones and twos. You're looking more at suppression than you are at control. But I think a big thing for farmers to remember is that resistance is a numbers game. The more individuals that you put any product on, the more likely you are to find the individual with the mutation to survive that product. So by using products that provide suppression, before you use an in-crop product, you're reducing the selection pressure on that in-crop product as well.
I think that was great. That gave us a really good picture of the overall herbicide resistance issue. And actually, yes, the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee has a really great infographic that says the percentages of resistance. So are you able to give us those stats? Because they are quite startling.
In the last prairie herbicide resistance survey, so this is numbers from 2014 to 2017 is when that survey was completed. 69% of the wild oats across the prairies were herbicide resistant. 62% were group one resistant, 27% are group one and two resistant, and 34% were group two resistant only. We are in the midst of the current herbicide resistance survey. So it's led by Charles Geddes out of Ag Canada in Lethbridge. The Saskatchewan results are in, the Manitoba results are currently being sprayed, and the Alberta results were collected this summer. So they'll be sprayed starting next January. Based on the Saskatchewan results, group one resistance in particular has continued to increase. In the Saskatchewan results, the group twos and the group ones and two multiple resistance had kind of plateaued, but we've seen those kinds of plateaus before, followed by a sharp increase in the next round of surveys. So I wouldn't expect that plateau to necessarily be maintained over the long term. And that group one resistance, as I said, is still increasing. I believe it was up to like 75% of the populations in Saskatchewan were group one resistant or something along those lines. So still seeing an increase. As I said, Manitoba and Alberta were working on those right now. So hopefully in the next year or so, we'll be close to having the full update from 2019 to 2023 instead of relying on the 2014 to 2017 results.
So with those startling numbers, what can farmers and agronomists do when they're looking in their fields? How do they spot herbicide resistance?
So I think a really good thing to do would be sort of middle to end of July into August is when wild oats start to poke their heads up above the crop. It's pretty typical by the end of July when you drive through the prairies, you can pick out where wild oats have survived in the crop. You see them, they're visible above most of those crops. If you have wild oats that are surviving at that point in time, I'd be asking the question of why. And sometimes you can go back and you can identify that, hey, there's a whole strip all the way down my field. I probably had a blocked sprayer nozzle or a spray mist or something like that. Sometimes you can stand there and go, yep, I knew this was coming. My crop had canopied and we got rain and I've had a second flush of wild oats that I couldn't get in to control. But if you've got a patch, and quite often it's a distinct little patch, it's not a nice line down the field, and most guys are running on GPS guidance down the field, so those lines are pretty darn straight if it's a sprayer mist. If it's not a straight line, and as far as you know, your herbicides worked and you didn't have a late flush of rain, you didn't really have a late flush of wild oats, I'd be questioning why is that patch there, and I would be considering sampling those seeds and sending them for resistance testing to confirm whether or not that's the issue you're dealing with. Now, if you wait until that time frame when those wild oats are above the crop, you've missed any chance of managing them really in crop. So even better, and people are going to shake their heads because this is a soapbox I get on quite often, is to scout after your herbicide application to actually see if it's working. Because if you can catch it early enough, if you're spraying at 3 to 4 leaf, you still have a gap there if that product didn't work to try and get something else. But at the very least, if you're seeing them above the crop towards the end of the growing season, I'd be thinking about sampling those for resistance testing.
I really love that takeaway. Often we are scouting pre-herbicide to see what weeds are out there, to see what product we need, but we should be going back out after to see how efficient it was and if we need to change our plans going forward as well.
Absolutely. And if you catch it within a week or two of your application, sometimes there's still a window there to manage it in that crop before it's just out of your hands. There's nothing you can spray. You don't have the equipment to do something else type of thing. That's really, I mean, we recommend it for every weed because if you're going out and you're having a dead plant right beside a live plant, side by side, you sprayed the same product. One's not obviously shaded. What, why? Why is one surviving and one is not? There's early signs of resistance that you can catch before you get to a full patch in your field.
So, can you just kind of jump into the method of proper sampling?
If you are sampling for testing, and I'm going to focus on wild oat, number one, you need mature seed. If you have really green, really immature seed, they don't grow. We can't spray them, so we can't test them. So they have to be mature seed. You need to collect enough for us actually to do testing on. We like to have 1 to 200 individuals growing per sample that we test. So we need, if you're getting 6 or 7 subgroups tested, well, we need hundreds and hundreds of seeds. One of the best tricks that I have seen for sampling wild oat for resistance testing came from Clark Brenzel. The sweep nets that the entomologists talk about having and going and sweeping your crops for insects. You can also take those sweep nets and swing them through a mature wild oat patch, end of July, beginning of August, and you will get a very nice, clean wild oat seed sample for use in resistance testing. It's a really slick little trick. And if you look on Twitter, it would be a couple of years ago now, but I think we shared a picture from a farm that had done this and has a picture in a sweep net, and it's just these gorgeous, well, wheat scientists, sorry, gorgeous, dry, mature wild oat seeds that are perfect for resistance testing.
That's awesome because as an agronomist or a farmer, you're probably going to have that sweet net with you anyway while you're scouting. So check for insects, check for and do your wild oat sampling at the same time.
Exactly. Entomologists and weed scientists supporting each other. Go use those
Exactly.
nets.
Love it. So there are only a few labs that you can submit samples to. Are you able to let us know which labs we can?
Yeah, so the Crop Protection Lab in Saskatchewan. Oh, wow, I'm even from there and I can't say it. Saskatchewan.
Very
Good
Canadian
Lord.
pronunciation.
Let's try this again. The Crop Protection Lab in Saskatchewan does commercial testing where you can submit your samples. It's, I think, $125 to $200, somewhere in there per sample. You can do this with other weeds too, not just wild oats. If you're putting in your wild oats, you can select sort of which of the group one subgroups you want tested, which of the group two subgroups you want tested, if you want triolate tested, and they will screen that and you'll get your samples back. AgQuest in Manitoba also does wild oat testing. And then the Pest Surveillance Initiative, my understanding is they do kochia testing, not wild oats. Charles Geddes in Lethbridge does some resistance testing, but only if it is a suspected novel resistance. So group one, group two, group eight resistance is not something he would test. For wild oat, it would be something like glyphosate resistance would be something that he would test, which we really hope we're not finding, but that would be something he would test. Otherwise, it's the commercial labs, Crop Protection Lab or AgQuest for wild oats.
So when you get your results back, is it a simple yes or no to resistance, or how do you interpret those results?
Oh, resistance results interpretation. This one's always fun. You have to have a clear picture in your head of where you sampled from. So the results that you will get back will tell you the percentage of the seeds that were tested that are resistant to that product. So I'm just going to pick a product, Pinoxidin. You got your wild oats tested for Pinoxidin resistance, and it came back that 64% of those seeds were resistant to Pinoxidin. Okay, so in that sample that we sent in, we have certainly developing resistance to Pinoxidin, even pushing into that higher levels of resistance. What did that look like in your field? Was it you had wild oats surviving across your field? So, okay, that resistance is probably pretty well spread across your field because that's where you sampled from. Or did you have one small tiny patch of wild oat that survived and that's what you sampled from? Because then what that tells you is that product worked still across most of the field and you only had one small area where that resistance is developing. Now, how you react to that is going to depend on your full spectrum of results. One of the questions I've had over the last few years since starting as a weed scientist here has been, you know, I sprayed X, Y, or Z product on my wild oat. I've got resistance. What should I spray? And I can't answer that. You can't predict based on a single product or a single subgroup which other products or subgroups you might have resistance to. It depends on the mutation. It depends on if it's metabolic. It depends on if it's target site. We don't have predictability without knowing exactly what the mutation is to know what other product will work. So you might get back results and you might say, okay, that Pinoxidin isn't working in this tiny little patch. So I'm still going to use that as an option in my herbicide rotation, but I'm going to add something else to that particular patch to manage that patch. If it's across the whole field, it might be, okay, that product is now out of my rotation and I have these other products that are still effective, so I'm going to go there. It might be that's the best shot that I've got left for an in-crop, so I'm going to combine a pre-residual with that with some other IWM strategy. So how you react to that really depends on what those results represent in your field. So when you are sampling for wild oat, I'd be drawing a bit of a map or taking a bit of notes on where did I sample from? What did this field look like? Take some pictures. This was across my field. This was a patch. What was it that you're dealing with? So that you know a little bit more about what those results mean to you when they come back.
So once you get your results back, you've interpreted them and now you have to come up with a plan. So you mentioned maybe spraying some other different products or managing that patch, but what else are farmers doing for an integrated weed management approach?
A couple of the things that we know work really well is to diversify a rotation. So when we grow a spring annual after a spring annual after a spring annual, our weeds adapt to that life cycle stage of our crops. If you have the ability to add a winter or fall life cycle stage plant, winter wheat, fall rye, winter triticale, anything like that, it gives the crop a competitive advantage against the wheat because it's up before the wild oats. So it helps compete against those wild oats. Fall rye is one that we've seen quite a bit of success with because it's quite a competitive winter cereal. Now, having mentioned that with winter cereals, one of the key caveats to that is that the winter cereal survives the winter. If you have poor winter cereal survival, poor winter wheat survival, and you've got a weak crop stand, that can be obviously sort of goes the other way for the wild oats because the wild oats will take advantage of that space and that vacuum essentially in the crop. One that I don't think gets used enough personally is increasing a seeding rate. We have seen really good results with increasing seeding rates of both wheat and barley to increase the competitiveness with wild oat. And I do get some pushback on you have to account for seed costs in that. But again, if you know where your patch is, you can increase your seeding rate in that patch. You can swing the seeder through one extra pass or across it if it's close to a headland and increase your seeding rate in that patch. And it can make a really big difference to the stand of wild oats. That's a big one. Giving your crop the competitive edge. So just good basic agronomics. Don't seed your crops 4 inches deep because they're going to struggle to get out of the ground. And I know that's a ridiculous exaggeration, but thinking about that seed placement, thinking about your fertilizer placement, making sure you're feeding the crop and not the weeds. Broadcast is sort of the extreme example. And we talk about it for all different kinds of reasons in terms of fertilizer losses and that type of thing, emissions, everything else. But from a weed science perspective, if you broadcast nutrients across the field, you're also very much feeding those weeds in the interrows and things like that. So that's kind of the extreme example, but don't feed the weeds, feed the crop. Don't stress your crop out. Don't put it too deep. You know, make sure it's got moisture. Make sure you're not having too much seed place fertilizer that you're burning it a little bit or stressing it out that way. Managing insects can actually have a big impact on your weed management. And I'm going to switch weeds for a second just as an example. It was such a visual example here. A number of years ago, we had pea leaf weevil invade some of our pea plots, and they hammered our pea plots. Our peas were really unhappy. And the cleavers pressure that came through those peas because of a non-competitive crop stand was incredible. Added to that, we had group 2 resistance in our cleavers, and we had sprayed a group 2. And we also got aphantomyces. Those peas had a very rough year that year. But the point stands. If the crop is fighting another pest, it's not going to be able to compete as well against the weeds. So that whole integrated crop protection, making sure your crop is healthy and happy, is also going to impact your weeds. I have to say it because I'm me and this is what I work on, but not spreading the wild oats across the field at harvest time would also be a good thing. So I'm the seed destructor girl. I'm the harvest weed seed control girl. So I have to bring it up here. Steve Shurtleff did research years ago that showed that combines are spreading wild oats up to 145 meters down the field. If it's a resistant wild oat, you just went from having a small patch to having a very big patch because you just spread it all the way down the field. So thinking about what our combines are doing with those weed seeds is really important. So either don't combine the patch, bale the patch, mow the patch, do something different to the patch rather than generously seed it across your field to be next year's problem. I'm obviously a fan of looking at the impact mills built right into your combine. Then you don't have to do anything to the patch except turn the mill on while you go through it. I know they're expensive. I know all of those things. And I do know that, you know, wild oat drops a lot of its seeds. So maybe it's not the best target for driving down densities with a mill. I get that. But those seeds that are on there are still being spread by the combine. Those few seeds, even if it's just a couple, you spread 5 seeds down the field and you spread 5 seeds from each of those the next year and 5 seeds the year after that, your wild oat problem has just grown exponentially. So not spreading those weeds, I think, is a really important one as well. And that comes down to if you've got resistant wild oat in one field, clean your equipment before you go to the next field. Don't drag them to the other field where you don't have a resistance problem yet or where you don't have a wild oat problem yet. Thinking about what am I carrying with me, I think is really important.
Those are all great tips to keep in mind for managing it. As you mentioned, you do work on stopping spread from the combine and harvest weed seed control. So what are you doing for research in wild oat or research that you know of that is being done?
Harvest weed seed control would be me. One of the main things we're focusing on right now is that patch management idea. So trying to actually document how big of a difference it can make to have a mill or have harvest weed seed control implemented versus not. So how big of an impact does that make on the size of your patches? So that's our big focus right at the moment with harvest weed seed control. We did just finish up our Harrington seed destructor work in the field where we're actually field testing it in 20 producer fields. It was only a 3-year project, so we didn't see a lot of significant differences in terms of numbers. And I will say from the science side of things, we learned a lot of things not to do when you're setting up these types of studies. And that information is going out to a lot of other folks working on harvest weed seed control so that we can get better data in the future. Just things like putting it in the weediest part of the field for our studies means that you're going to have a much longer term study to actually see results because there's just so many seeds there. So things you learn as you go. In terms of wild oat in general, I want to use a couple examples from my program. I've got a study looking at competitive wheat and barley varieties. So I have irritated myself over the years by talking about integrated weed management and recommending farmers use a competitive variety. And inevitably, I get asked, well, how do I know which one's competitive? And I say, you don't, that's not available to you. So that point was really not useful to you at all, but you know. And so what that project is looking at it, and it includes wild oat in sort of a wheat community, is trying to develop a method where we could actually rank wheat and barley varieties in terms of their competitiveness. So similar to how there's a ranking given for a variety for their disease resistance, susceptible, moderately resistant, you would have a competitive, moderately uncompetitive maybe, and then non-competitive or something along those lines is what we're trying to develop so that that information could actually be included in the seed guides. And I know it's not going to be a top priority for choosing a variety, but maybe if you've come down to 2 varieties, both are a good fit, that might be that one additional step that you take for your weed management. There's similar studies going on, sort of system studies. We just finished up a 5-year study looking at crop rotation, increased seeding rates, chaff collection as a harvest weed seed control method with and without in-crop herbicide applications, including wild oat. In a couple of those treatments, we were able to go 3 years with no wild oat herbicides and have the same wild oat densities as the canola wheat with full herbicide applications. One of those strategies in that study that I didn't talk about in the IWM that is a gross miss on my part is silage. Early cut barley silage, so if you can cut the barley within a week of head emergence, can be really, really effective on reducing wild oat densities. In some of the work that my predecessor here, Neil Harker, did, he, with 3 years of early cut barley silage, had lower wild oat densities than growing barley for grain with full herbicide rates on a non-resistant wild oat stand. So that early cut barley silage, barley is a very competitive crop. Increased seeding rates and early cut silage can really make a big difference on wild oat densities because you're also preventing any seed bank inputs. Areas of interest that we've got research proposals on right now includes things like trying to understand group 15 resistance, so trilate and pyroxasulfone cross-resistance. We know we have a population that has resistance to pyroxasulfone and trilate in the group 1s and 2s. That was in Manitoba. That was work done by Amy Mange. Amy Delacuy is her married name now, when she was a master's student. But trying to understand that sort of trilate pyroxasulfone resistance, we're seeing group 1 mixtures coming out and trying to understand what is the impact of those types of things on control, what's the impact on selection pressure, because that's something we really don't know yet with wild oats. So trying to understand some of those things, you know, from the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee perspective, we had a group of farmers in Daysland that we were sort of encouraging just to try wild oat management things that were, there was a couple looking at inversion plowing, trying to bury those wild oat seeds and then sort of switch back to a no-till system. So one extreme, I guess, tillage event to bury those seeds and then go back to sort of a no-till system and see what that did on the wild oat densities. And there was even, they pulled out a rotary hoe and used that in a no-till situation, which was surprisingly less disturbance than I expected it to be considering how it was previously used. But looking at things like that as well and just trying to listen to producers and hear what they're willing to try, wanting to try, and what could work in their management systems too.
I know I'm personally excited for, I think, the competitive variety research that you're doing.
Yeah.
Not only is it a Sasquatch funded project, but I think it's something that I've preached as well as an agronomist, like use a competitive variety, but we just don't have that information to back it up. So that'll be really exciting to have. And then I think the group 815 cross resistance as well, with that switch in herbicide reclassification, I think that's going to be something that will be really great for farmers to have information on.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see this summer with doing both the wheat and the barley competitive varieties. And we seeded the same weeds across both crops. You know, I do get questions sometimes on why I recommend barley over wheat when you're dealing with a significant wild oat issue. It's because barley is more competitive and it was visual this summer. Oh man, was it visual. We had quite a few lamb's quarters in those studies. And when you've got 6 to 8 foot tall lamb's quarters, it stands out quite a bit compared to, you know, a couple of lamb's quarters in the barley. And so there was definitely visual differences between the wheat and the barley, but there was also, you could walk through and go, ooh, that's a good variety, because there was just fewer weeds showing up above the crop canopy. So there's definite differences there. It's kind of fun to see it visually.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all of your information on not only the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee, but also on wild oats. Just to kind of end it off, what do you think is to come for the Resistant Wild Oat Action Committee, and how can farmers follow along?
You know, we've got big plans and big dreams, as everybody does. We definitely want to continue to provide resources, and some of that is listening to what farmers want and need information on. So if there's questions that you have, you know, send them our way so that we can actually produce some of those resources that would be valuable to you. So definitely focusing on continuing sort of our infographics and our fact sheets and our resources and things like that, hopefully a few more videos. And we're looking to team up with some of the commodity groups a little bit more for on-farm research so that we can get some data on how these strategies might be working on farm too. So that's sort of some of our goals. We've got another proposal in under consideration for funding right now, and if that goes through, hopefully we'll be able to keep providing some of these resources to farmers as we go.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Wheat Profit Podcast.
Thanks for having me, and hopefully we hear from a lot of farmers on this. It'd be great.